Hey guys, the following podcast is a Lady Gang Network and Podcast One production, which means it's going to be awesome. Welcome to The Short Stacks, our shorter conversations with authors about their process and their books. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and our guest today is Jamie Attenberg. Jamie is an author and essayist, and she has written a whole bunch of books, including the critically acclaimed All Grown Up and The Middlesteins. Her newest book, which came out on October 22nd, is All This Could Be Yours. Today, Jamie is here to talk with us about her new book and her writing life and a whole bunch more. Here is your weekly reminder. In the show notes, there is a link. That link will take you to all the books discussed today, as well as the social media accounts for the Stacks and our guests. Plus, if you shop through the links on Amazon, you're helping to keep the Stacks free. If you like the Stacks and want to support the work we're doing, here are a few easy ways you can help. First of all, you can join us on Patreon. You earn perks like our virtual book club and get to connect with other listeners of this podcast. Plus, you get to rest easy knowing your contribution helps to make this show possible. So head over to patreon.com/thestacks to be a part of this fantastic community. Another way to support the show is support our sponsors like Audible. They're your go-to destination for all things audiobooks. Plus, if you listen to this show, you get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download. So sign up at audibletrial.com/thestacks. The last thing is the easiest. Just subscribe to The Stacks. Leave us a rating and a review. It's super helpful and it's super easy. So please, please, please take a moment to do that. And of course, we always invite you to tell someone you know about the show. Now it's time to hear from Jamie Attenberg about her brand new book, All This Could Be Yours. All right, everybody. I am here today with author Jamie Attenberg. Her brand new book, All This Could Be Yours, is out October 22nd. Jamie, welcome to The Stacks.
Hi.
Hi, we're so excited to have you today. We always start in the same place. So in about 30 seconds or so, can you tell us about your book?
So my book is called All This Could Be Yours, and it's about a family, the Tuckmans, and the patriarch of the family, Victor Tuckman, is on his deathbed in New Orleans. And so all these family members are sort of coming in to New Orleans to grapple with his death. And he was like a terrible human being. Like absolutely the worst kind of man ever. So it's about that, and it's about the city of New Orleans too. Like it's a look at the city of New Orleans, and that's it. I feel like it's also an American novel too.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I really appreciated about the book is that you're writing a story that many people are familiar with in some version or another, whether it's in their own family or they're familiar with this idea of kind of the evil patriarch or whatever that looks like from another book or something, but you've really taken a fresh perspective on it. You've really adapted it in a way that it doesn't feel like every other book about a bad guy. So I think that's really special. Where did the idea for the book come to you?
I mean, well, I just want to say that I think part of the reason why it doesn't feel like a book about a bad guy is in fact that it's not really about him.
Right.
It's really about kind of like all the people in his family and the damage that he's done in his life. Cause I was, to be honest, just like not super interested in another story about a man like this. And he was very incidental in a way to the telling of the story. So I got the idea. What I was really thinking about was a family, grappling with death when you don't like that family member. That was part of it. And kind of thinking a little bit about grief and how we sort of all have to go through grief, whether or not we liked the person we're grieving over or not. So those are really interesting and kind of juicy dynamics as a starting point. And I really did want to set a book in New Orleans. I've lived here for regularly for almost 4 years now. And I'd set my last couple books in New York. I'd had a couple of books that were set in the Midwest. And this was my first book that was going to be here. And I was trying to, it took me a really long time to figure out how to tackle this city. And I really only feel like I've just begun.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've had other authors on who live in New Orleans who've moved to New Orleans, and they've talked about really wanting to have New Orleans be a part of their books. I wonder if you know why that is for you, at least. What makes you feel like...
I moved here because I loved it here. I lived in New York for 18 years total. So I had finally found a place that was as interesting to me as New York City was.
Okay.
I think that people wrestle, I'm not sure if this is exactly what you're saying, but I think people sort of wrestle or are occupied with the idea of writing about New Orleans, but we all sort of like want to figure out the right way to write about New Orleans because people are really protective of this city. I feel protective of this city and I'm new here. And rightfully so. I mean, it is an incredible special place that has just such a rich culture and such a rich history, but also so many problems. So, and it's a small city and it's really hard whenever you meet someone and say you live in New Orleans, like 9 times out of 10, people are going to be like, oh, I love that place so much. Yeah. So I think there's like something about it. People just have come here and had really memorable experiences. But you want to get it right because if you get it wrong, boy, are you going to hear about it.
From the people in New Orleans.
Forever. Yeah. So, and I'm sure I didn't get everything right. I had so many people read this book who were from here, who have lived here their entire lives. I was like, please do not be shy. Tell me what I, you know, got right or wrong about this city. Cause I don't want to be, I mean, but it happens anywhere. You know, like I remember I wrote one book set in Chicago, which is like, I was born and raised in Chicago, and I had people correcting me on things. So,
well, because everyone's experience of a place is different also.
Absolutely. Like, how can you even, you know, that's like part of like growing as a writer or as an artist and like learning that you're just not going to please everyone or really anyone. Like there's no one ever reads something of mine and thinks this is exactly how I would have done it, you know?
Right.
So that's why it's really important to just write the book for yourself first.
How long did it take you to figure that out?
I would say, I honestly think that, it wasn't really until my fourth book, which is a book that I got a lot more attention from I was touring a lot more and I was engaging a lot more with people and seeing them and seeing their takes on it and realizing that, and it got reviewed more and just sort of realizing that people just bring their own experience to art, to any kind of art or any kind of cultural experience. So you just sort of have to like allow that. So I sort of feel like when I do these interviews, I mean, I'm happy to talk to whoever and I'm always amazed that anyone gives a shit ever about anything that I write. But in a way, it almost doesn't matter what I think about my work or what I intended with my work. I have really specific goals and things that I want to achieve and stories that I want to tell. And it's magic when it works. But also, even if people can take a fraction of what I intended away from the book, I'm happy with that because I'm sure I think about all the songs you listen to on the radio right. in your car or whatever, and it just glances off of you and there's somebody who spent time writing that song and, you know, there's studio engineers and people packed and it just sort of goes away like that. So, right. So I get that not everyone's gonna, you know, be interested in what I have to say, but I do hope they enjoy it anyway, the experience of reading it.
Right. So one of the things that stuck out to me in this book, and I'm a little nervous to talk about it because I don't know that I'm going to do a good job. So let's see how it goes.
I think you're going to do a great job.
Great. Thank you. There is a lot of trauma and abuse in this book that is trickled down from the parents. And I don't want to spoil anything because I'm assuming people haven't read the book yet if they're listening. But the way that it's depicted in this book is almost casual, the way that it's handled between the characters. And I'm really curious about that because I feel like in this moment in time, politically, culturally, abuse is being handled so specifically and deliberately and with so much, like, you know, I'm having a hard time even articulating myself because I'm worried I'm going to say something wrong, but in a way where we're really taking care of the victims, which I think is new. And I was just interested in the way that you wrote about it. Some of it I think probably is generational because the characters are older and so they don't have that same...
It's not as immediate.
Yeah, but I'm just curious about why or why it wasn't or if it was important to you to write about abuse in a way that feels less precious, maybe.
Yeah, it's a little, it's at times, I suppose, a little more matter of fact. I mean, I'm a minimalist writer, yeah. and I don't want to make, you know, I had wariness of making anything feel sexy or compelling beyond, I mean, I just didn't want it to be, to feel that way. I wanted it to be like, these are the facts. But beyond that, who the abuse happens to, I don't want to give anything away in the book, I think it's fair to say that I really didn't make a lot of the abuse happen in the present tense of the book.
Right.
And it didn't really happen to any of the children in the book or anything like that. And I was interested really in exploring, like, we know these things happen. Now what happens after that? That was what I was interested in. Like, what happened? There's a million abuse narratives out there.
Right.
So it really was like, how does this impact this family? How does it get passed on from generations? How are certain people complicit in that? So it's not very cut and dry. It's not like this, even though there is like this very bad man in the world, he doesn't get stopped really.
Give anything else away. I know it's kind of tricky to talk about it. Yeah, it's tricky to talk about, but I do think it's worth bringing up the way that the abuse is handled in the book, because I do think it's different, and in a good way different. I didn't feel like you were writing about abuse the same way that everyone else is writing about it. So that kind of was where my question was coming from.
I think, let me just add one more thing to it, which is that I think that I started writing this book, and while I didn't necessarily at the time think of it as, oh, this is my like Me Too book, the fact is I started writing this book like a month or two after like everything was really exploding with Me Too. And so it was like this glut of horrible things that had happened that every day I just remember sitting at the computer crying and saying how sorry I was to so many people for all the things that had happened to them.
Right.
And I didn't want to live in that world,
right?
So it might be that I sort of went to the next place with it, or a different place with it, because you're sort of figuring out whose story it is to tell also.
Totally. Are you familiar with the play Burn This by Lanford Wilson?
Mm-mm.
It's a play from the 1980s, and he calls it his AIDS play, but it has nothing to do with AIDS. And it's kind of in a similar way where it has to do with a gay couple who die in a boating accident, and the people in their lives are left to kind of deal with it and figure it out. But there's no AIDS, there's no sex, there's nothing to do with it. But it does have to do with the idea of losing people in the gay community and what that means to the straight people that are left behind around them, sort of. And that kind of reminds me of what you're saying, that while this book is infused with Me Too because of the time, it's not necessarily a hashtag Me Too story.
It's sort of like whatever comes next. I mean, I really feel like in general, all of my peers, post the election have been like, we all went through this place where we're like, how the fuck are we going to write about this?
What are we doing?
And then the fact is that you write about whatever you want to write about. Like, you write about whatever comes next in your head, and maybe you take the time to sort of recover from something that's happened, and then you just move forward. I've had this really interesting experience where my last book, All Grown Up, came out kind of around the same time, but like a little bit before it. But when I've gone and toured in Europe, because it came out later in Europe, all I got asked about was Me Too. For a book that didn't exist. I mean, it didn't exist when Me Too happened, or it did exist. It was written before Me Too existed itself. So that's a really interesting experience, because that has like by default become my Me Too book.
Right. Well, and that's kind of what we were talking about earlier. You can't really control how people are going to receive the work, or how the time might change the work itself.
Yes, you can't see your audience can't see me, but I'm sort of wildly moving my hands around and shrugging like I have no control over it.
Once you make it, you kind of let it go and hope that the world responds.
Because but truly, like the thing about Me Too is that when it happened, it was like, oh no, Me Too has been forever. And obviously there was the first version of Me Too ever 10 years ago or whatever that was, but really, like, I've been writing about men being shitty to women my entire career.
Right.
So this is not anything new. None of this is new for me, because none of this is new for anyone.
Right, exactly. We just have new words for it, or
new
hashtags. I want to go back to the book a little bit. How do you name your characters?
Oh, well, they're sort of, I think it's very fun for me, I suppose. I mean, Barbara Tuchman, who's the mother, I named her after Barbara Streisand, even though they're nothing alike, but she's spelled, it's just like a reminiscent of the era and this sort of, she, I could just picture her like putting Barbara on the stereo, you know, walking around thinking, you don't bring me flowers anymore or whatever. And then, you know, Victor, it's a very obvious name because he is the victor. I always tend to have a character who has a female character who has like a gender neutral name. Like Andrea was my last one, and there was a Robin in there. And so Alex is that character. And then, you know, Gary, these are all the family members. And then Gary is like, I think when I went to Hebrew school, I had like 10 Garys in my Hebrew school. So it's like he's my generation. So you just sort of feel it out. Sometimes it's really symbolic, and sometimes it's pop culture, and sometimes it's personal things that are buried deep within you that no one would ever know.
All right. What about the title? How did that come to be?
Well, that's a phrase that has stuck in my head since my childhood, because I grew up watching Price is Right and other game shows like that. I don't know how old you are. And sometimes when I say this to people generationally, they have no idea what I'm talking about. And also like in your, like my foreign, publishers, this title means nothing to them at all, but it's really like that moment when, during the showcase showdown and Price is Right, when they bring out all the prizes and they show you everything that you could win. And then they say, oh, this could be yours. Price is Right. So it's about, this book one of the themes of this book is it's about capitalism, and it's about the desire for those shiny objects. And so it just, and the motivation of some of these characters is I just want shiny objects. I'm an American, and this is what I want, and this is what will make me feel happy and feel safe. And so it doesn't matter what kind of decisions I make, as long as I get the things that I need to make me feel safe.
I'm old enough to remember Price is Right.
Okay, good.
I actually live right up the street from the Grove, which is where the CBS at the Grove, which is where they film The Price is Right. And the other day I was walking down the street, and it was right as they were getting out, and everybody had the yellow stickers on their chest with their names on it and their shirts, like, I'm with Gary, and like, Gary's 80th birthday, and like the whole thing. So
honestly, my heart beat a little bit faster just hearing that you were even near it. I should just go on that.
Yeah.
I should go hang.
It's Drew Carey now is the host.
Yeah. I mean, it was like the days when when I was watching, it was like Bob Barker, and then who just didn't age at all. And then they just sort of pulled him off eventually.
Right. That's what I remember being younger, like staying home from school and being able to watch it. But anyways, I digress. What was the hardest part about writing this book, and what about this book came easily to you?
So I would say the hardest part, which we've discussed a little bit already, was writing about New Orleans. That was really my biggest challenge. Because I just, you know, as I said, I just wanted to make sure that I got it right. And I really agonized over it. But also it was great because I got to ask lots of questions of people. And I walked a lot. I walked all over the city. I did a lot of driving around the region too. So it was, I don't know if it was hard, but it was challenging, right? So that's fun. That's juicy. That's like, you want that as a writer. I think what came easiest to me was, I feel like the Tuchmans, I just knew the core family like really well right away. I mean, they're not anyone that I could say that I've ever met before in my life, but at the same time, as soon as they showed up, I knew who they were. And I was like ready to kind of just take them on and figure out what I liked about them and what I didn't like about them. And so they were, again, it's not easy, but it felt familiar. Whenever a character shows up and they feel like you know them already, then that's who I want to hang out with and spend time with.
Right.
You know, sometimes I'll think of an idea for a book and I'll know what the ending is right away. And that, that's not a book I want to write, but I do want to write a book where I can get inside the skin of the character.
Right. Right.
That's like creepy. I don't know. It's a little creepy.
It makes sense. It makes sense. As long as we don't find out that you're a serial killer, I think it's not that creepy.
I don't have the focus or motivation to be a serial killer.
You have to be really meticulous too. You gotta have a big plan.
Right.
How long did it take you to write this book? You kind of mentioned that it started in the early Me Too days.
I think I decided, because I have a book that comes out pretty much every 2 years, and I have had that for the last 13 to 14 years. So I think I've decided that the first draft usually takes me about anywhere from 3 to 6 months. So there's sort of a first draft that's like a first slash second draft that's like, it's like fine, but it's got something. And then there's a third, fourth, and that usually comes in the first 6 months. And then you get edits, and that's maybe another three or four months. And then copy edits usually take me about 2 months. So it's about a year cycle to write, and then it's about a year cycle to publish. Right. Yeah, meaning going through all the marketing and advertising and cover design and all that kind of stuff.
Right. When do you let someone else read the book? Where in that process might you hand it off and say, what do you think?
So I would do, sometimes I'll do like a 50 page to a couple early readers and say, is this anything? If I'm feeling
not sure,
good about it. I send the first 100 pages to my agent. Okay. So he's sort of the first big read. And he doesn't usually give me notes. The idea behind it is that he will tell me, he'll ask me a couple questions and I'll just sort of make sure that I know what the big picture is on it. And I'll say, is this a thing you can sell, or do you think the editor is going to want it, depending on whether or not I already have a book deal in place? And that's usually the conversation we're having. I would say 2 or 3 times I have thrown books away based on that conversation, where he's like, here's all the things that you would need to do to make this work. It's fine. Everything you write is fine. Everything's at a certain level. But here's like things that you would need to do to make this work and for me to be able to sell it. And then when I think about those things, whether or not I want to do those things, I never want to do those things. And I know he's right. And I know that it's just there's too much that isn't working
right
for me to try and fix it.
So I've never thought about this before, but you just saying this kind of made me. You've written a lot of books. You're what I like to call a professional writer. You write.
Yes.
You're a real-deal writer. Do you get competitive with yourself in your writing? For example, the last book I wrote, All Grown Up, you know, it was acclaimed. This happened. I did this. So when I go to All This Could Be Yours, I have expectations for myself that maybe, or for this book.
Yeah, they all have to be better.
Right.
For sure.
But how do you define better, I guess, is kind of what the question is.
It sort of has to feel fresh and new. I mean, I feel like my themes are always the same in a way. They've evolved slightly over the years. And as I grow as a person, they kind of evolve slightly. But what I really want is for it to feel structurally interesting and just a very fresh experience for the reader every time. So for me, like The Middlesteins was a family drama, just as an example, it was a family drama and it was written, it wasn't linked short stories, but each chapter you could really fold out every chapter and it could have lived in its own universe. And then Say Maisie was, there's interviews, there was a diary format and there were multitude of voices in there and it was historical. And I was like, this is brand new for me. And then All Grown Up was first person, like a claustrophobic tight first person, narrative with like kind of limited plot, but like big emotional moments and gestures. And it was very funny. It was a very, very really focused on it being a very funny book. And now there's this one. So, which is also very different structurally. Most of it takes place, the present tense of it, over the course of just one day. So each time I think that people who read me regularly, which there's not that many of you, but some people who read me regularly get that each time they're going to get like a new experience.
Right.
And that's my challenge. I don't know if I'm competitive with myself, but I have a set of rules that I have to abide by. And each time it has to feel different.
Okay. So this is some of my favorite stuff that I always like to ask authors, which is, how do you like to write? Where do you like to be? How many hours a day? Do you listen to music? Do you have snacks and beverages with you? Are you in your home? Are you at Starbucks? Like, what's your reading world or writing world look like?
Well, I get up really early, like 6 in the morning. And you know, I'm not always writing because I have other things I have to do just work-wise, like being part of like being a professional writer is that you have to do interviews and and other kinds of things. But when I'm writing, when I really have that 6 month period that I've blocked out, I get up really early. I walk my dog for probably 45 minutes. I come home, I have a coffee, I read a little bit, then I handwrite. I tend to handwrite in the mornings. At this point, I don't have to count. I have an idea of when I'm close to 1,000 words. And then in the afternoon, I'll type it up. And in terms of snacking, I do snack. I do try to get exercise in. I've found as I've gotten older that it's really helpful. But in general, walking is an important part of my process because I just think about everything and I just get like amazing ideas just pop off in my head when I'm taking a walk. And that's it. And it's not any sort of magical experience or like extreme rituals because it's just my job. There's no secrets. There's no shortcuts. You know, like that's it. You just like sit down and do the work every day. You get up every day and you just do the work and then the words appear before you.
Of course. Have you had any other jobs pre-writing, pre-being professional writer?
I've had every kind of job there was. I waited tables for a long time. Probably, I think I started, I feel like maybe like 5 years or something like that. Cause I started in college and I did it for a couple years after college too. I got a degree in creative writing, which meant I knew how to write sort of when I graduated, but I didn't know how to be a writer or what that means or looks like. So I did that. I've done that. I've painted houses. I worked in a nursing home. I worked doing IT stuff. Like I ran video conferencing for an advertising agency. I did a lot of internet stuff. I temped so many horrible office jobs, like you would not imagine or not believe. I worked for different nonprofit organizations. I mean, I just worked. My first book came out when I was like 34. So between the ages of 18 and 34, I had every job that you could imagine. And then I still continued to do freelance work up until my fourth book because I was a writer who didn't really make a living at it.
Right. But did you always know you wanted to be a writer?
Kind of. I mean, I was writing little stories when I was 4 and 5, but I didn't know what that, you don't know what that looks like. No, there's no, no one really tells you. And I feel like, it's not a really glamorous, exciting job, except that it's super glamorous and exciting inside my head. Like that I really love, but most of it is just you sitting by yourself in a room. And how do you tell someone that's what the job is? And you have to be, I think, the kind of person who likes sitting by themselves in a room, which really isn't everybody. Lots of people love to read and lots of people think they have a good story. But the truth of it is like it's an incredibly lonely profession.
Yeah. I'm one of those people. I love to read and I'm not a writer. I have no interest in writing. There's no part of writing is something that I like, but I love reading. And I think that I think that's a weird thing sometimes. I think most people who love reading as much as I do have some idea of I'm going to be a writer. I'm going to tell my story. I'm going to write my novel about my life. And I think to myself, that's the last thing I would ever do.
But no, but do you think I keep meaning to look up the science behind reading and like what it does to your brain because I don't know enough about it. But I just when I have those moments where I'm reading a book and all of a sudden attached to the book or the book sort of attaches itself to me. Do you know what I mean? Where you're like, okay, I'm in. Like I just read Kevin Wilson's new book. Did you read that yet? Nothing to See Here. Oh, it's so good. And I was like 10, maybe 5 or 10 pages in and I could just, there's something that goes on with your synapses. I'm certain someone's going to listen to this and tell me what it is. I guess I could just Google it. Maybe I'll do that. But it just does something so magical to your brain. And I also am so interested in like how when I read on a computer screen, I know a lot of people are reading digitally on iPads and stuff like that, but I haven't started doing that yet because I find that the experience of reading on a computer screen, I take in so little of it. Huh. Whereas read a book, I'm like, I tend to remember things more. I think I'm terrified of the internet. Mm. I mean, I'm attracted to it, but I need it, but I'm also just super terrified of like, you just never know what terrible word's going to pop up. You know, at any given moment. And I, like sometimes when I'm just so like feeling so bad because I've spent too much time on the internet, because it genuinely bums me out, the internet, on a daily basis, because the news is so terrible, but also like you can just sort of see people being really cruel on it. There'll just be this moment where I'll just go and read a poem.
Right.
I have this piece of paper that I wrote. I posted it actually on the internet, but it's just like a little sticky note that I wrote once the impeachment started. And it just says, if you get too upset, walk away from the computer. Just like a reminder, like, how do you feel right now? Do you feel terrible? Then you should just walk away from the computer.
Right. Such a good reminder.
Which is not like, lots of people don't even have that, obviously have that privilege of like, well, I can just walk away. Like they're at their office, they're doing for a job, or like they don't have access to a computer, but the bad things are actually just happening to them in their real life. But I think that I try to figure out how I can be of service to people, and me angry is not going to be of service, because
right.
there's me problem solving is of service.
Right.
And when I'm angry, I don't solve problems.
Yeah. That's good self-awareness, but also a good trick. If you can get away from what's making you angry, just walk away for a moment, take a breath.
I'll tell you what, it's usually the computer.
Yeah, totally. Twitter.
Yeah.
It's always Twitter. At least for me. But I love Twitter and I hate Twitter. I have a really...
Yes.
Because it's a great place to hear other people's ideas and thoughts on things that you might miss because of your own positionality in the world. But then also it's a toxic place for hateful people to be very horrible.
It's terrible. For me, it's where almost every essay assignment that I've had in the last 2 years has been an editor reading a tweet of mine and saying, will you write about this for me? Or Instagram.
Right.
So I have enough. So it's not like my, I don't know, it's like my LinkedIn or something
like
that.
It's like a business card.
It really is my business card. And it's like a great place for me to generate ideas. And I've made friends off of it and really keep in touch with people. And it's a great place to promote your work for the most part. And so it's all those things. And then beyond that, like I have real friendships that have formed off of it. And I can see how people are doing and people can see how I'm doing off of it. But in the last couple of years, it's just turned into like such a hellscape.
It's like horror story after horror story. Well, on a slightly better note, before we wrap up, for people who read your book, love your book, All This Could Be Yours, what are some things that you recommend to them to read that are maybe in conversation with, or you feel could be similar, or just a good companion piece?
Oh.
Or things that maybe you were reading while you were writing the book that you feel like are in there?
The kickoff book for me was Meg Walter's last book, The Female Persuasion. I read that and it just did something magic to my brain. I love the structure of it. And so I thought, why don't I just sort of like not write a book like this, but use this as an entry point into writing my own book. And I liked the way that she wrote about feminism, and it's very different. It's a very different book than mine. There was a book of poetry that I really loved when I was writing this book called Absolute Solitude. Mm-hmm. And because a lot of this book is actually about loneliness, and I'm sure I'm going to like pronounce her name incorrectly, but it's Dolce Maria Loynez. She's a Cuban writer. I don't know if she's still alive anymore, actually, but it's like a collection of her work over like many, many years. And it's just gorgeous. So those are kind of the two books when I think about this book that were with me the entire time that I was writing the book.
I love that. And then my last question for you is, if you could have one person, dead or alive, read this book, who would you pick?
Well, you know, I'm a Grace Paley head. Okay. So like, I just to have her near me for a second would have been nice. I saw her once on my college campus. I was an undergrad and she was teaching like maybe like a week, classes for a week or something. Like, she was like the visiting scholar, and I saw her walking towards me on the quad, and it was like this angel, you know, this gray haired angel coming towards me across the quad. And I was like, Grace Paley. And so that was, you know, I would love for her to have read my work, because she meant a lot to me.
Well, Jamie, that's it for me. Do you have anything else you want to say before we get out of here?
No, I thank you so much for having me, though. I really enjoyed this conversation a lot.
Well, thank you for being here. And remember, everybody, you can get Jamie's newest book, All This Could Be Yours. It's out October 22nd. Go get it wherever you got your books. Jamie, thank you for joining us.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you. And we'll see you guys in the stacks. That does it for us today. Thank you so much to Jamie Attenberg for being our guest. And thank you to Taryn Roeder for helping set up this interview. Remember to get your copy of All This Could Be Yours wherever you get your books. And you can use the link in the show notes to buy your copy and help support The Stacks. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out the website, thestackspodcast.com. To join The Stacks Pack and get inside access to this show, go to patreon.com/thestacks. Thanks to Audible, listeners of this podcast get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download by going to audibletrial.com/thestacks. Make sure you're subscribed to this show wherever you get your podcast, and if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please rate and review this show. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegirigis. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.